welcome to the 8th episode of the SRA podcast. This is your host, Alex Yumba, and for the second week in a row, we have someone else joining us on the show to help discuss various topics and bring their own personal insight. This week, we have with us Brad. He is one of the members of the SRA Central Committee and a very, very helpful organizer. He is actually in charge of helping our chapters get off the ground, providing any assistance that members may need and getting other people organized. So welcome to the show. Glad we can have you on.
Thanks, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
So we'll dive right into the first story we got this week, which is from the University of Utah. This popped up on my feed just recently. A graduate assistant made the news as when they published their course syllabus, they included a segment in regards to students with concealed carry. They said they would designate a 3x3 square in the back of their classroom for students who wish to exercise their Second Amendment rights, as it was phrased. This is in reference to the free speech zones that have popped up across the country where universities will designate a particular area where free speech is allowed, as it were.
Utah is already a campus carry state, is that correct?
Yeah, campus carry law took effect, it looks like, in August 1st, 2016.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a ridiculous stunt.
Yes, it's a little bit, I could see it more if this had happened when the law first passed, but being almost 2 years after the fact now, I don't know exactly what their thought process was. Maybe it was in protest of these free speech zones, but if it were, the sources I've included say that the Utah legislature removed these free speech zone restrictions in 2017, so now I guess anyone can speak their mind anywhere on universities, outdoors at least.
It's not clear to me if this person was trying to do this as a statement against the free speech zone or a statement against campus carry.
The way it was phrased in their syllabus, I would assume that it was against the campus carry, because in their syllabus they described bringing a concealed weapon into the classroom as, quote, absurd, antisocial, and frightening behavior. Also, they included this statement, quote, this zone does not include a desk because desks are reserved for students who respect the personal and psychological safety of their classmates and instructor.
Okay, I gotcha. I must have missed that part on the outline you sent me earlier. So yeah, that makes sense.
So my confusion arose from the fact that part of a concealed carry is that it's concealed. And so if somebody is aware that you're concealed carrying, it's no longer concealed. And in some states, making somebody aware that you're concealed carrying is itself criminal threat.
I can speak as a professor in Georgia. I've been teaching in my state for a while, and we have a campus carry law now, and I'm forbidden from asking if any students are armed or carrying. And I think rightfully so. If you're going to have a concealed carry environment, we're not supposed to bring that up. And it's almost, if concealed carry is the law of the land, doing something like this, even as the son it were, seems dangerous. Like, who has a gun?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the thought process was, that especially given the political climate in Utah, I'm not exactly sure what they were seeking to do with this, but it hasn't ended well for them. The university has said that they've been removed from that class and are being given other assignments. How much longer they have their job is up in the air, given that this is a graduate assistant and probably doesn't have the same protections of tenure that a professor might have.
Yeah, it seems like unnecessary showboating of the issue there. There's some dumb gun discourse in this country sometimes, and I guess you can throw this one on my pile.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. But that's a good transition point, dumb gun discourse, into our next topic, that we have a article I selected off of the refuse pile of the internet. This was written by Daryl Perry for the Honolulu Civil Beat. He was a 40-year law enforcement veteran and police chief of Kauai for 11 years. He has since retired, and I guess he now occupies his free time with internet articles such as this. So he wrote an article entitled "The Second Amendment is a Blight on Civilization." And the gist of this article is when the Second Amendment was written, that was to protect against King George's tyranny, and now we have no name for it, and also the Founding Fathers could never have imagined a world where the AR-15 existed, so...
There's some nice quote for this about, we're no longer in the situation of, what was it, urgently resisting tyranny? Do you remember the way it was phrased in here?
His direct quote is, "Such is not the case today. The Second Amendment must be repealed because the same justification no longer exists."
Thinking that it's not the case that we're urgently resisting tyranny today. Like, imagine thinking that.
Yeah, I don't know what his exact political beliefs might be, but given that he is in Hawaii and given the political discourse there, I imagine he's probably not a fan of the current administration.
It's hard to comprehend exactly what he was going, the thoughts he was going along with. And he also tried comparing us to he said, look at the system in Britain.
Yes, he did say that, he references Great Britain saying that in, I believe he said, in one day, we have as many gun deaths as they have in Great Britain in a year. And so he's saying, well, let's follow their example that obviously they're doing something right when that one isn't adjusting per capita. Of course, Great Britain has a much smaller population that isn't adjusting for sheer demographic differences. That's this one problem. Whenever we could compare it to Europe, Europe does not have the same demographics nor the same history that went into those demographics. It's a lot easier for, obviously Great Britain isn't as homogenous as Scandinavia, but it is a lot easier for them to be like, well, they don't have those cultural things that we have that have been instilled into our zeitgeist, as it were, that a lot of violence that's perpetrated is against disenfranchised minorities. And of course, as a police officer, perhaps he's aware of this, but not speaking to choosing not to speak about that.
Just great difference between us in the United States on this topic and them across the pond. Is it's not even like comparing apples to oranges here. And it's, you know, you got to ask the question, what about forgetting just the gun culture in the United States? Like, what about all the guns in circulation? Like, I mean, what's he proposing here? A voluntary buyback, I've heard from this sort before, like in Australia, but I don't know about you, I ain't voluntarily selling mine to anybody. And do you think the right's going to? I doubt that. Or how do you think confiscation would work? So what's to be done about, you know, all the guns that are already, you know, out there here in the United States? You can't just sign a law and expect that, we'll be in that kind of situation shortly.
Yeah, and I remember reading some articles about New Jersey. New Jersey passed some bump stock stuff and other firearm accessory laws and said, you have until this date to turn all your stuff in. And I think they got like 2 turned in out of the entire state.
Yeah. And that's, you know, yeah.
So voluntary gun buybacks, unless you're offering a lot of money, I don't really think that's going to be effective. And certainly the only effective regulation is one that's nationwide, because of course you see in states like California or Illinois, you just go next door to buy your guns now. Of course, California has now made it to where if you are a resident of California and you bring back a gun, then you're a felon if you don't immediately register it with California. But how many people are actually doing that, and how many people are just taking the bet that they're not going to get caught with it?
Sure.
Oh, there's some more key quotes out of here that I'd like to bring attention to. That here's a particular quote. "Our founders had no idea that someday, based on a person's right to own a firearm, an individual without cause or justification would walk into a school and murder defenseless men, women, and children. They had no thoughts of a sniper from a vantage point in a hotel would murder people enjoying an outdoor concert, or a disturbed person gunned down innocent people at work in a new media news station." The main issue I take away from this is, it's acting as though in the 1700s we existed in this magical time where people didn't shoot other people outside of warfare.
There were no gun murders back during the founding of the country.
Yeah, I don't know what he's trying to go for there, because I'm pretty sure the founders were aware that people shot other people outside of the military, and I don't know. It's this sort of logic, because I'll put it out on the record, I don't agree with the philosophical justification of the founders said this was the right thing to do, therefore it is the right thing to do. That's not good, because the founders were working on very different philosophical foundations, and most of them were slave owners. So I don't think it's a good idea to base your logic on the founders said X is okay, so X is okay. But at the same time, if you're going to argue from that basis, you have to at least keep your argument internally consistent.
Sure, I agree. And I mean, I don't like at all using the Second Amendment as an argument for gun ownership. I mean, the Second Amendment itself is, you know, not good. It's got a foundation of white supremacy. What did they want the guns for at the time? But it's still like adapting to where we are today. That's what gives the working class the right to be armed right now. So it's while arguing for gun rights from the purpose of a Second Amendment isn't good as arguing for anything else from the perspective of the Constitution. But this guy is definitely, his angle is just to go after gun ownership altogether. But so yeah, I agree with your point there, as well as noted.
Which, of course, this being the SRA podcast, it's worth discussing what philosophical foundation we do have to be able to say, well, why should we be armed? And I personally always go back to the foundation that regardless of your beliefs on individual gun rights, because this is something that comes up as the rights of the individual and the rights of the collective to own guns, I think regardless of where you fall within that gradient, the philosophical foundation for leftists and gun ownership is the working class is the only class that this can apply to. No matter what regulations, no matter how stringent you apply this, because the capitalist class, the ruling class, will always have access to those resources, because the military is beholden to the government, and in many cases the government is beholden to whatever capitalist aristocrats are behind it.
Sure. You know, I'm a Marxist, and I believe that it's quite clear in Marxism what the position on this is from many different people, Marx and Lenin and others, that you can't, we haven't achieved socialism here. We're still involved in the class struggle. We're still, under the thumb of the capitalist ruling class. And what we do aim for is revolution. And I think it's, you can find numerous sources throughout Marxist study, if you go back, that it is important that the working class not be disarmed, and that only the bourgeoisie, have the means to possess firearms and use them. It's we're still engaged in the class struggle, and it's just as a communist, it doesn't make any sense to say that the working class should be disarmed while the ruling class and their police still are. It's a preposterous notion to me. The fact that the Second Amendment is what gives us the ability to arm ourselves here in the United States, that's not ideal, but it is what it is.
I also find it interesting that, to kind of round off this, the article in question, he kind of ends it on the point that we have all these deaths from cancer, we have all these deaths from driving accidents, we have all these deaths from this and that and the other. And then he says, okay, 37,000 people in the U.S. died by firearms in 2015. And of those, 8,000 were murders. It's interesting he brings this up, because when you look into these statistics, suicides make up half of all firearm fatalities.
Sure.
And that would be a good thing to bring up if you're discussing gun control, is, oh, we have all these people that are committing suicide. But the reason this just doesn't get brought up, and I keep bringing this up and up and up, is that if you admit to the fact that, oh, most of our firearm fatalities are from suicides, then you are forced to confront question, well, why are people committing suicide in such huge numbers?
Sure, yeah.
So, and one of those things where you can make the numbers say whatever you want, just depending on which ones you choose to pick out.
And ultimately, I don't think that this guy believes in any way whatsoever in a world completely free of guns. I believe he means, just the general population being freed of guns. I don't think he has any real desire to completely take them away from the police or the military or into the hands of the ruling class.
Yeah, I didn't do too much in-depth research, but from the best I can garner, the Kauai County Police Department still issues firearms to its officers. So during his 11-year tenure there, he did not do anything about that.
So he didn't remove, okay. I gotcha.
So we'll close off that discussion and move right into some changes the DNC has been undergoing. So for those who just woke up from a coma for these past few years, and if you were in a coma for the last few years, please stop listening to this podcast.
Or have a favor. Seat at the very least. Sit down.
Yeah. Either have a seat or just stop listening and go to the Amazon basin and save yourself from all this. The 2016 election happened, and during that time, there was a lot of controversy in the Democratic Party, as of course we have insurgent revolutionary comrade Bernie Sanders speaking such socialist ideals as maybe we should give people health care. Which of course frequent listeners will know that's not socialism, but we'll pretend that he's a revolutionary for the moment, because that's what the DNC pretended he was. During this time, he faced something of an uphill battle against Hillary Clinton, who from the very onset the party was intending to have as their candidate. This was second time's the charm for her. Of course, she did go on to win the primary, but there was a lot of controversy and debate over superdelegates, which technically both parties still use. The Republican Party still has a superdelegate system. It is drastically cut back, which is ironic given the political standings of the two parties, but it caused issues there in the beginning, because anyone who was following, and you can still see some screenshots of this from back then, the vote aggregators from like Google and the New York Times and such included the votes of the superdelegates from the very beginning. And as Democratic superdelegates are drawn from the party elite, so congressmen, congresswomen, congresspeople, governors, high-ranking party officials, they get to pledge their vote whenever, and they all pretty much immediately pledge to Clinton, which gave her a like 500-600 vote lead there at the right there in the beginning, which meant anyone checking there at the start of the races would see that, oh, she's already got this huge vote lead. So
yeah, I remember, you know, when you would log in to Google or any other source to check the primary results during that, it would always show this big lead with Hillary Clinton because they were counting the superdelegates.
And that definitely has a psychological effect on people, that when somebody looks and sees that their candidate is so far behind, they say, well, I guess it's already gone.
Yeah, and there was the atmosphere at the time, too, is, you know, we must defeat the Republican. It definitely had to have swayed some people.
So afterwards, this has been a great debate within the party for a while now. So they've finally gotten around to approving changes for the upcoming 2020 primary, that they will not allow superdelegates to vote in the first round of voting. So basically they can't pledge until the actual party conference where they officially select their delegate. So if there's a relay race or more and the votes are split, then on the second round of voting, the superdelegates can cast their vote to pick the winner out of there. This is interesting to me, because at the same time that they're doing this, they also did a transition. They didn't make it official party policy, but they did make it a very stern suggestion that states move away from the caucus system, mm-hmm. where you have people show up at town hall meetings of sorts and ask them to go to the primary system, where people just show up at the ballot box. And this is interesting to me, because in Kansas, we still run a caucus system. And Bernie Sanders won overwhelmingly here in Kansas. I think it was like 72% is how much he got here. But it makes you wonder, and of course we saw this, that in states that held caucuses, Bernie Sanders was much more likely to win, and with a much greater margin, because caucuses, because you have to show up to the town hall, because you are in a group of people basically yelling at each other until somebody wins, it encourages candidates with a lot more activism on the ground versus the ballot box, where it's just a standard election. And in states that had primary elections, Clinton usually won.
It more than makes you wonder that, because, you know, the machinery behind the DNC is still the same, and they don't want an even vaguely left candidate, I don't think, to win. And I don't know that this so-called reform is much more than something they're doing to try to give the appearance of what people have been demanding about changes from within the party. Like, for example, like, what if, you know, the coming economic crash, which we all know it's coming, was to happen before the next election, and it was really bad, and people were really angry, and somebody even further to the left than Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez were to, you know, start becoming like a very popular candidate. Do you think they would just, you don't think they would try to step in and prevent that? I'm not at all convinced. And, you know, it's not the only reform that the DNC has been making lately. Have you heard that they rescinded the restriction on taking donations from fossil fuel companies, which kind of, you know, let you know where their heart still is? And I can't help but wonder, in that scenario, that somebody, you know, very populist, sort of maybe even actually socialist candidate trying to run on the DNC ticket, what they would do if that were to be the situation in 2020.
Yeah, and it's, I've talked to people before that this is one of those great debates of reform or revolution. Refer to Rosa Luxemburg for that, and how that turned out for the reformists. I definitely have talked to people, especially during my time being involved in the College Democrats back in 2015, 2016, when I was just starting out with this sort of line of thinking, that a lot of people see this as a gradual step over that. Okay, we start with a guy like Bernie Sanders, and then he opens up the field for somebody even further left, and then they open up the field for somebody even further left, and before you know it, we've gotten to this point. And I'm not going to completely discount that, because we saw that happen in Latin America countries, that there were countries in Latin America that, via the democratic process, were able to elect honest-to-God socialist candidates from a liberal democracy. Of course, in those situations, they were very quickly paid a visit by the U.S. Marines or the CIA. But I think here in America, the problem we have as far as the reform goes is that both parties are so firmly entrenched in this capitalist system. And as you just said, the DNC's making changes to make that even easier, to make corporations meddling in their candidacies even easier. I don't see how, at this time, in this political climate, and the way the parties are structured, how somebody who doesn't have strong corporate support could actually get a significant standing in the Democratic Party, especially when you have people like Elizabeth Warren, who is quickly looking to be the front runner in 2020, specifically going out and saying, no, I'm not a socialist, I believe in compassionate capitalism.
Yeah, and reforming capitalism. And I personally do not at all feel like the Democratic Party is any avenue to revolution in this country, or even if, you know, and as we see is likely to happen, or perhaps could happen, a candidate or two get through, the entire party is beholden to capitalism, and this is very pro-imperialism. So, like, what one person in the Democratic Party could even do is questionable to me. And the whole notion of taking over the entire Democratic Party is not a new idea and has not worked yet.
Indeed. Well, we will go ahead and make the transition to the next topic in socialism. That we have a couple articles that were written recently. One on the Wall Street Journal entitled How to Argue with a Young Socialist by Crispin Startwell. And then a response to that article, How to Reply to a Patronizing Wall Street Journal Reader by Nathan Robinson.
Both of these articles were something else. The first article is just being ridiculous. And to me, I was kind of struck, at least my personal opinion, by what a poor, or not poor, but very weak rebuttal that was given in the second article.
Indeed. For the listeners who don't want to pull it up on their phones quite yet, the gist of these articles were, the first on the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Startwell was saying that we shouldn't introduce socialism because if we did, then because we don't like Trump, because Trump is a fascist, we would just be handing him the keys to power. So if we instituted the, I don't know, United Soviet States of America tomorrow, that Trump would be some awful dictator that would cause no end to trouble, as though that isn't already happening. But he's arguing, well, socialism necessitates a strong state, and so we're just asking for Trump or somebody like him to take over, and then won't we all feel stupid when they start oppressing us? It's worth noting that the author is an anarchist capitalist, so he's got some interesting views.
He actually says early in the article, like, exactly what socialism is, that's kind of a vague or tricky thing that I won't try to address, which that was like within the first paragraph or two, and the rest of the argument kind of hinged on his sort of weak understanding from there on out. But he was definitely going from the angle that socialism involves making the government bigger, that socialism is big government. It was what he had in mind of that he seems to think socialism is, or what he was pitching socialism, which I think he sometimes described as democratic socialism, was just an expansion of the welfare state. And that he's like, well, if we're going to expand the welfare state and the state's going to become much bigger, do you really want Trump in charge of a more powerful state? And this was his, what he considered to be a magic bullet for arguing with young socialists.
Well, and certainly I could see that maybe working on a few new converts to the DSA, but as the rebuttal went on to speak about, and the problem is that this is one of the traps that we have to be careful about when arguing with these people, is if somebody starts with a flawed premise, you can't argue on that flawed premise, because you're falling into the same logical fallacies that they've started with, and you'll never be able to win because they have rigged the game for their side of the argument. And this is kind of what the rebuttal by Mr. Robinson was saying, was, well, how do you abuse the welfare state? The only way you abuse it is to take it away, is basically what he was saying. And this is a little bit disingenuous, because there are plenty of ways that you can abuse a welfare state. Here in Kansas and other Republican states, we've continually ran into the issue of people in power wanting to start adding stipulations to welfare programs. So, for instance, a candidate for governor here was running on the platform of, we should have a work requirement for benefit programs. This is obfuscating the reality that most people on benefit programs are working. They just have extremely low-wage jobs. Other more successful platforms in other states have been, well, let's attach drug tests to it. Let's make sure that nobody who's on drugs can get benefits, which is really going to help people who are dependent on drugs to get undependent, that by taking away their benefits, that's really going to work. So there are definitely things that a state can do with benefit programs that would start, you wouldn't want a government run by Trump necessarily to have, but the problem is that this isn't the magic bullet for socialism, because socialism isn't welfare. That's the social democracy.
Yeah, exactly. The rebuttal of this argument was about, well, if we expand the social, if we expand the welfare state, then it could, you know, easily fall into the wrong hands, or like Trump, and you want him to have a bigger state. But we don't wish to merely expand the welfare state. We wish to completely overturn the current order of things. As far as it falling into the wrong hands, but we're ultimately out to unequivocally defeat the wrong hands and remove the ruling class from power. We don't want a state that would have the opportunity to be in wrong hands and to abuse, because we wish for the working class to have power. And, you know, I'm a Marxist-Leninist, so I believe that we should have states in the interim period, but between the transition from capitalism to communism, I do believe that socialists should try to build socialist states from which to dismantle the capitalist and imperialist state and fight fire with fire. But it's not going to be any, it would not be anything like we perceive of the state when you have these kind of thoughts of, well, what if it gets in the wrong hands like Trump? We wish to defeat that capitalist ruling class, and the state would, it's about the class character of the state, is that we would wish to put it into the hands of the working class. And other left tendencies don't even like this interim period is that they wish to abolish states immediately, or some of the more anarchist tendencies. And while that's a different issue, I think that arguing or trying to rebut this by saying talking about the expansion of the welfare state is not at all the way to go, because what we're talking about when we talk about socialism is not merely an expansion of the welfare state.
Indeed. And I think it's worth pointing out as well that when I hear arguments of this nature where people say, well, what if it falls in the wrong hands? Exactly what you're saying, that, well, we're out to remake the entire system. It's kind of like, I look at it, if you look at other transitional periods in history, where, for instance, when we transitioned from the monarchical societies to liberal democracies, it's in a way saying, well, what happens if you take the king's power and you put it in this parliament, and then the mob takes over, and now we have mob rule, what's going to happen then? And it's like, well, that's still a problem. Mob rule is still a problem, but that's a different problem. You can't justify, well, we should let the king stay omnipotent because we can't have the people running things. In this same sense, we have this basically saying, well, you can't introduce socialism because then you'd have Trump running things. Well, yeah, exactly what you said. In a socialist state, Trump's not going to be around.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. I agree.
Hey folks, for a first in the show, we're having a bit of an ad break here, and as some of you might be aware, I don't run ads on this podcast. I don't really have enough listenership for anyone to want to run ads on it to begin with, and in addition, I'm not sure who'd want to run ads on this podcast, and also that would be kind of weird having me promote products to you on a leftist podcast. So, you know, that would not be ordinary, we'll go and go ahead and say. So instead, I have been looking at how to monetize this podcast, because it does take a fair amount of work for me to do this on a regular basis, and this is something I like to do. I like doing this. It works well for me. It works well for my family, and I would like to be able to make this into a more justifiable endeavor, as it were, that as much as I really like doing this, I still gotta eat, just like anyone else. So I settled upon the idea, after talking to the community, that I started up a Patreon for this. Currently, I've got just one tier for $5 a month. This is mostly just a show of support. I am working on premium content. I want to have like some behind-the-scenes stuff, maybe some discussions that get left on the cutting room floor when I'm putting these episodes together, or maybe just special content altogether. It's kind of up in the air right now. I'm always open to suggestions, what I can do to make it more worthwhile for people to maybe give that bit of money each month towards making this project more viable. I have already received a decent amount of support on Patreon, and I want to say I'm really thankful for those who have already decided to chip in some of their hard-earned labor vouchers towards the show, and I hope I can continue to make this better and justify people supporting it monetarily. So now, with all that said, back to the show. Transitioning to the next story, we move away from socialism to the capitalist state that we currently exist under. We have a couple things to discuss. Firstly, Elon Musk, a frequent topic of the show. I'm not sure why. I don't know what I have against Elon Musk, but he just keeps popping up and I just keep talking about him. His bid to take Tesla private has failed for multiple reasons. First of all, Tesla's shareholders told Musk that he can't do that. I guess they don't have interest in just selling their stock at this time. It surprises me a little bit because Tesla's stock rating is in the trash right now. Tesla's about to run out of cash on hand, and they can't find anyone to give them money because Musk has run this company into the ground. He also claims that he's decided against it on his own accord because he read into how you take a company from public to private and said that it's too bureaucratic and too much of a hassle, so he doesn't want to deal with that. In actuality, he probably doesn't want to deal with it anymore because the SEC is now investigating him for trade violations. It is illegal to manipulate stock prices, especially for a public company. So when Musk sent out his tweet saying that he's going to sell Tesla stock for $420 a stock, when the price at the time was like $300, that could be construed as illegal market manipulation. For the record, their stock price has gone back to about $320. The reason I bring this up on the show is this is a good example of how the media can be distracted by something like this. That one of the reasons I bring up Tesla is because it continues to be an example of how an eccentric individual like Musk, who wields so much power in a company, can just do horrific things to that company, that he is not running the company in a very good fashion. And this means that for the workers that rely on their jobs in this company to continue to feed their families and themselves, well, what happens when Musk runs Tesla into the ground because he's made all these promises and he keeps trying to find outs for himself? And part of this public to private transfer would have been he would have sold most of his stock. And so most likely going private would not have saved Tesla, because it does have a very serious cash on hand problem at this time, because they aren't actually selling products at a fast enough rate, which means that this is ultimately something that Musk would have saved himself while at the same time damning his workers. And I think this is one of the examples in capitalism of where you can have these big famous eccentric individuals that the media will fawn over. And I mean, people call Elon Musk the real life Tony Stark and give him all this praise for his genius, when his famous tactic is he makes a company and then he sells his share of it and takes off somewhere else. And some of them have worked out, like PayPal, and some of them haven't. And who gets left behind when he does that?
You were saying in your introduction to this bit that it seems like you Elon Musk just keeps coming up, or that you would just keep and end up talking about Elon Musk on the show. And as I think you've alluded to, he's a particularly noticeable example of the internal contradictions of modern capitalism. It's so blatant and it's so obvious. It's not at all what capitalism promises of as production and innovation is what drives the market and what makes money. Because like you said, that the company has just been running off of public funds and other just sort of clear nonsense in the stage of capitalism that we're in now, with like investment capital and the intertwining of capital and the government. And Elon Musk and his ventures are just, even if you don't have the words for it, like even if you're not a Marxist, even if you're just like sort of an average person, I think it's just still a very noticeable example that you can't take your eyes off of, because the internal contradictions are always there in all segments of capitalism with all the billionaires, but he's almost like a particularly flamboyant example of them.
Moving away from capitalist ideologues, demagogues, to more inspiring news about ideologues getting torn down, we have the story out of the University of North Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Silent Sam, a Confederate statue that was erected in, I believe, the early 1900s by the support of the Daughters of the Confederacy or something like that. It was a statue of a Confederate soldier. He is so-called silent because I guess his rifle doesn't have any ammunition left.
They call a lot of these monuments silent sentinels, I guess because they stand there stoically. I'm not really sure the origin of the term.
So it's interesting to me that this statue isn't commemorating a general or such. Usually these things are made out of generals, officers of the Confederate military. This is a regular soldier, I guess, an attempt to appeal to the everyman. Nonetheless, this statue has attracted quite a bit of controversy because I don't know of many other countries that actively allow the erecting of monuments to attempts to secede from those countries. I think usually that's not a common occurrence, but admittedly, I haven't really studied that issue at large in the international scene. It's just something that is unusual to me that we have this cultural mindset of, well, we should allow people to do this because it's part of their history, but whatever. There was a protest held at the University of North Carolina around this statue. During that protest, the demonstrators were able to topple the statue. The statue was quickly taken away by officials from the scene. It's being held at an undisclosed location until they can figure out what to do with it. The university officials say that they plan on putting it back up here in the near future.
We'll see.
We'll see. I know you said you were kind of involved in this, or not this particular incident, but this sort of demonstrations against these statues.
Yeah, this story hits home for me because I have a Confederate monument in my hometown. I was born in Gainesville, Georgia. I live right outside of it now, and we've got a Confederate monument called Old Joe. And just last Saturday, a group of local comrades was protesting it for the second year in a row. This is the second year we arranged the protest. We did it first last year in wake of the death of Heather Heyer, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. I was organizing with DSA at the time, and the DSA had put out a call saying that anybody that had Confederate monuments, because, you know, Unite the Right was partially part of the messaging was about a Confederate monument. And so DSA National had sent out an email saying, if you've got a Confederate monument in your hometown, maybe you should protest it. I've always had my eye on that ugly fucking thing anyway, because, you know, who wants to have a Confederate monument in their hometown? So we decided to go ahead and protest it. It was a very difficult protest the first time. It was Northeast Georgia DSA, a DSA local that my wife and I had founded, and we've got several comrades had rounded up, and there was a massive counter protest presence, and there was a very massive aggressive police presence, but we got through it fine and with no arrests, and the monument still stayed. So this year, on about the round exactly 1 year later, almost not quite, but almost, we although the DSA local doesn't exist, it's a there's sort of we kept the gang together is an independent local coalition of left-wing activists called Socialist Organization of North Georgia, and we went back, and we were joined with our comrades for the Party of Socialism and Liberation, which is beginning to get a very strong presence in Atlanta. I'm a candidate of the party myself now, and the Atlanta chapter, I believe the Atlanta branch, was just officially recognized as a branch recently, or is about to be, one of the two. And so they joined us along with some Socialist Party USA comrades, and I will say we had less counter protesters this time. We had another successful protest against the Confederate monument. We changed our messaging a little bit, and it was a good protest, and we're prepared to keep fighting and going back and doing it again. I wrote an article about the protest for PSL, which is, again, the Party of Socialism and Liberation. They have a website called Liberation News, which is a really great website. It's just worth checking out anyway. They talk about a lot of both stuff that's going on in politics and also things like this, and so be looking for that to drop maybe within the next few days, maybe next week, if you want more details on that protest. It's liberationnews.org.
I'll definitely include a link in the show notes. We're recording a bit in advance, so that article may be out by the time this episode is out.
They said they usually got a few days turnaround, so if people want to check out more details or our strategy the second time and just a lot more information about the story, that they can check it out then. And if you're publishing on Tuesday or Wednesday, then yeah, it might be up by then.
Yeah. So something I found interesting reading about this, that just a little tidbit that stood out to me, that apparently since this statue has attracted so much controversy, this thing I was just doing a rudimentary research on Wikipedia, and the source on there claims that the security for the statue is nearly $300,000 a year. And it makes you wonder, $300,000 a year out of a university's budget, how strong of political force has to be behind that to justify what is multiple people's salaries to keep this thing around when a simple vote from, I guess, the North Carolina Historical Committee or whatnot is what decides whether the statue stays or goes.
It's not only ridiculous to spend that much protecting it, but like you were saying, it's ridiculous to even have these monuments to, not only are they monuments to a failed slaveholders' rebellion, but the reason these monuments were put up, you know, they were put up in the early 1900s and throughout the mid, like, you know, 1940s and 50s, I think a lot were erected by groups like United Daughters of the Confederacy as a means to intimidate Black Americans and as a, you know, part of the general push for Jim Crow and segregation. They're not just, you know, honoring the Confederacy, but they were put up for a very particular reason. And a big part of that reason was sort of as a intimidating reminder of Black Americans during the segregation period that white reactionaries intended to further subjugate them.
Indeed. And I find the significance of this statue particularly interesting because, as I was saying earlier, because it's not an officer of the army, that it's this everyman, this common soldier, that it kind of perpetuates this idea that, in a way, every capitalist state does this. But I think especially for a country like the Confederacy was this idea that, oh, well, you had the leaders fighting amongst themselves, but you had the honorable everyman who just stood up for his state and his country, and that he was removed from this political discourse and just fighting out of personal honor and ethics and whatnot. And of course this is outrageous on a few accounts. That,
yeah,
one, most the there's a lot of debate, and this is a huge historical thing of that you can find books and books and books about this, of how much did the poor white portion of the South support slavery. And there's a lot of conflicting reads you can get out of that, because unfortunately the institution was so deeply embedded into the society, and especially after the first few slave revolts happened in the early 1800s, particularly the South Baptists began incorporating it into the religious doctrine. That was a big turning point, that the Southern Baptists began really pushing that from a religious standpoint of slavery is okay, and because religion held such sway over the population, you see by the time of the Civil War, a lot of people have grown up indoctrinated into that system on every front in society. But at the same time, for a lot of, regardless of the everyman's views on the system, these people, I'm sure many were volunteers and fought willingly, but in every capitalist system, you have a lot of folks who will fight, even if they volunteer of their own accord. They're fighting because the system compels them to. That, how are you going to look to your society if you don't stand up and volunteer to do this? And so it's spreading this message that your every man is fighting for his family, when in fact, regardless of how you cut it, still fighting for the society, still fighting for the institution of that society, and for the Deep South, that was an institution of slavery.
Sure, those are great points. And I'll add one last thing, that as a Southerner, what was actually thought of during the Civil War versus what we hear today is drastically different, because there was a very large scale, very intentional revisionist history project called Lost Cause Ideology down here, which was meant to, after the fact, recast the Civil War as in different terms, which, without, you know, going into too much time, the Lost Cause Ideology is that it was, you know, later said that they were fighting for states' rights, and it was a very intentional project to sort of change the terms in which people, future generations, thought about the Civil War, especially down here in the South. And, you know, somebody who was raised up in the South and at school in the 80s and 90s is very clear in the textbook that it was a very successful project. We would read things in our textbooks and be taught things in school that were just drenching with this Lost Cause ideology. So there's that aspect of it as well.
Definitely. Transitioning away from the topic of the Confederacy and the demonstrations against its relics, we'll move into a story that caught my attention earlier this week. Previously on the show, I discussed the DEF CON conference in Las Vegas, where basically a bunch of computer enthusiasts and hackers and the like go to discuss computer security, the current state of electronic lights and these sort of things in the world. It's a very fascinating conference. They do a lot of stuff there. Part of it is they do have a sort of children, teenager section of it where your kids can go and do fun little activities. This year they had the activity Hack a State Election, which just sounds like fun for the whole family. But this isn't too unusual. They have stuff like this every year. But this time around, one of the participants, a 17-year-old, was able to make it into the national mainstream news by saying that they were able to easily hack a state election at the conference. So this article written by the individual in question says that, well, I'm not a very good hacker, and it took me 5 minutes of Googling to take down this state election website. This is disingenuous, to say the least. So first of all, I don't think this teenager is doing this out of malicious intent. I think that they're just a teenager and they're really happy that they were able to do this. And I'll reserve the more nastier terms I could use, but we'll say a disingenuous journalist picked up on this and had them write this article. I'm sure the editors at the platform were changing a few things and encouraging some wordings of things to fit their agenda. But basically, I've included an article that rebuts this as well. First of all, this was an exercise. So this was a set up controlled area where this was the intent, was that was literally hack a state election. So the organizers for this section at DEF CON took a copy of some of these state election websites, and then not only intentionally introduced some vulnerabilities, but were also there acting as mentors, actively helping these teenage participants get to the intended outcome of hack the state election website. It's a learning exercise. It was not set up to be a honest to God security test. It was a fun exercise for teenagers is what it came down to. It's also disingenuous the way this article is presented, that it's acting like he was able to hack the entire election. In actuality, it was a vulnerability that was being exploited by the MySQL databases on the back end of just a front-facing website. So using an example I know, the Kansas Secretary of State's website has the results of the election available a few days after the election, the preliminary results, and it gives you a little Microsoft Excel spreadsheet that tells you what all the various districts won and what votes. That's not actually the votes that the government has decided on. That's just the copy they give to the public. So if somebody were to go to the Kansas Secretary of State website and hack into it and make it so that I won the governorship, I would not be declared governor, because that's not the actual votes that people are counting. That's stored machine side at the voting booth in Kansas. We are fortunate that we still have paper receipts. Some states have moved entirely to whole electronic no receipt systems, which is just mind-boggling to me, and that does introduce its own security vulnerabilities. But as far as what happened at DEF CON, that at this particular instance, it's a non-issue. It's nothing burger, as some individuals would say.
Yeah, I don't have much background or computer expertise to comment on the technical aspects of it, but two things that I take away from stories like this all the time is that a lot of this, while we should be concerned about the integrity of our elections, of course, a lot of the stories you see currently in the mainstream media around elections and voting systems are deeply tied up with the ongoing Russiagate narrative. And you have to really think about who's pushing these stories and where this Russiagate narrative is going. And it's starting to almost morph into like, well, what about China? And almost, you worry about it leading to some kind of, military activity or war. It's the whole Russiagate phenomenon, the whole thing surrounding it. It was sort of springboarded off of these election integrity issues, but it's really becoming sort of a more worrying overall trend, at least to me. And two, as somebody who's been in activist circles for a while, one thing that I've noticed in particular is that with a lot of the more liberal activist circles, some of them have actually taken this to quite an extreme where they're doing a lot of their organizing around voting systems or removing voting machines. You know, some people in the public, it's even gotten to such a point with the Russiagate hysteria that some people actually believe that, like, the Russians, manipulated vote totals in the 2016 energy, and it's 2016 election. And I can't help but notice that, like, for some, certain segments of liberal activist circles, this whole elections influencing thing is actually starting to divert some activist energies, which might have been, used for other issues like healthcare or what have you.
Indeed. I worry about stuff like this because there is a limited amount of political oxygen in the room, as you were kind of saying, that you can only focus on so many things. And it does seem like this Russia scandal is sucking up a lot of the political oxygen out of the room. And I'm still working on my special episode compiling all this. And what I found as I've been doing my research on it is just how much things can change so quickly. And I think that this ties into this notion that comes up as far as reactionaries of the Democrats and the Republicans being cut from the same cloth, that who is this actually serving?
Exactly.
And it's fascinating to me that we see, and this happened here in Kansas, that our Secretary of State, the man in charge of reviewing the elections, is running for governor, and he was able to win the primary for the governorship by a very narrow margin. Like, I think it ended up being less than 200 votes out of 300 and something thousand cast. So by a very narrow margin. But until those votes were certified as official, and until his main opponent, the current governor, conceded the race, he was saying, well, we can't be sure there was no election meddling. And then the moment it's certified that he won, it's like, oh, well, obviously the vote counts are fine. And the Democrats are feeding into this thing to this narrative that the Republicans have pushed, not as obviously in the past, but still this notion of our elections aren't legitimate has been very bubbling to different extents throughout the years in the Republican Party, and especially after 2008, when we began seeing this huge rise and just vicious rhetoric from the Republican Party out of the Tea Party in reaction to Obama's election. We've reached this point now where not only are the Republicans saying, well, we can't trust the elections because we have millions of illegal immigrants and the Democrats want millions of illegal immigrants to vote for them and we can't trust the elections. Now we also have the Democrats saying, well, we have Russia. The Russians are meddling in our elections because we couldn't win the election that we were prophesied to win because it was a slam dunk case, but we're such a poor party that we can't do that. Now we have that from both sides. And what I genuinely fear as we see the rhetoric rise around this is that this is putting the thought into people's minds that, okay, the elections aren't legitimate. Okay, if the person I don't like doesn't win, then the election isn't legitimate. And we have sources from within the White House administration that Trump asks every now and then, what would happen if I suspended the elections? And it's mind-blowing that a sitting president of the United States can even dream of that thought and not immediately be met with, oh my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? But I think it is because both sides now are just drenched in this idea of our elections aren't valid anymore. And so it's very easy then that I don't think that we're quite to the point where Trump could announce, I'm suspending the 2020 elections. Congratulations, I'm president for life now. But at the same time, it's building to that point where if your elections aren't legitimate, then it's a lot easier to tell people, well, why even bother with them?
Yeah, and not only all your points I agree with, but you know, like as you said, who is it serving and where is it going? I those of us who have been paying attention, and I you know, think a lot of people have noticed and pointed this out, that the rhetoric has already gone from Russia interfered with our election and we must defend our electoral system and the integrity of our elections. It's moved, it's morphed from that to we must take action against and sanction Russia in the you know, most severe way possible, or we must take the senators or congressmen saying that we must bring the Russian economy to its knees. And now it's expanded. They're talking about, you know, taking tough action and sanctioning China and Iran and North Korea. When it comes to U.S. imperialism between the two major parties, there is no opposition party. They're both on the exact same page when it comes to the U.S. empire. So it's a good point.
Indeed. I think that's as good a place of any to put a pin in that until I inevitably come back to it and what's probably going to be a 8-hour documentary series of just the mess we found ourselves into this time around.
I'll listen to the whole thing, Alex, so at least one person will.
We'll get into some rapid fire stories right before we get to the kind of main story and the conclusion of our podcast tonight. So just a few short stories that have come across my radar that are worth mentioning. We have one out of Louisiana that there was a hazing case where a member of a fraternity, they were playing a drinking game. I guess they were downing, it says, 180 proof grain alcohol. So pretty potent stuff. And then they are chasing it down. And one of the guys was losing the game pretty bad. So he drank a lot of alcohol. He was found later unresponsive. His fraternity members took him to the hospital. He was declared dead on arrival. So, of course, the police are now investigating this. And one of the fraternity members involved apparently has evidence on his phone pertaining to this, but his phone is encrypted and locked. The reason this is an interesting case is that it's kind of gone against the grain in the U.S. that most court decisions have decided that under the Fifth Amendment, since the Fifth Amendment says you can't be compelled to testify against yourself, the courts have held this to mean that passwords are a method of testifying against yourself, that if you have locked data and it's encrypted, you can't be compelled to unlock it. There's a few justifications around this. You can kind of see one of the bad things that happens with this in like a country in like the United Kingdom, where this is not an explicit right. People have actually gone to jail for a very long time because they were caught up in some kind of criminal case. And unbeknownst to them, their computer had a virus on it, and most viruses will encrypt themselves to avoid being tampered with by antivirus programs. They weren't aware of this. This isn't anything to do with them. The police find it on their phone, say, please unencrypt this. Say, I can't. And police say, okay, you're going to sit in a cell until you come around to unencrypt this. So you can end up in situations like that. But here in the United States, generally, the courts have held that you can't be compelled to give the police a password for your encrypted device. This court ruling was saying, well, no, actually, you can be compelled because the police have a good idea of what is on there. So it's kind of this idea of foregone conclusion that the police say, we know what's on that phone. We are 100% confident that the evidence we need is on that phone. So you have to unlock it for us because we already know what is on there. And I see this as a problem because, of course, as in activism circles, encryption is a very good policy because police will go on fishing expeditions. And if you give them unfiltered access to your devices, that can mean a lot of bad things for you and others.
Yeah, this is definitely an interesting story that's going to be important to keep an eye on because of its implications.
Indeed. We have a story out of Georgia, just a funny little thing that, I mean, funny if you like that sort of thing, I guess, that a Georgia school superintendent was brought up in a civil court case about the firing of a paraprofessional. So there was a paraprofessional who, I guess she made a suggestion to change some school colors to recognize the black students at that school. Shortly thereafter, she began receiving poor performance reviews and was eventually terminated. So she sued for racial discrimination. Part of the discovery proceedings of that court case, got audio recordings of the school superintendent talking to other employees and making very regular use and very derogatory remarks about the black employees of his school district. Obviously, we will not be repeating anything he has said, but there's an article for anyone who wishes to read about that. I don't know if this is actually in your area. Did you check this story out?
I'm not sure that I'm familiar with this story, but I mean, it's, you were saying it's funny for in its own way. We're a barrel of laughs down here. I mean, it's a very reactionary state. It reminds me of something that was going on in Kennesaw University lately that was in the news. It was similar. It was real quick, some cheerleaders, I believe last year during some football games, kneeled during the national anthem, and they were suspended. There was a big hoopla about that. Some people fought back, and the you know, cheerleaders, I believe, were reinstated and allowed to, you know, cheerlead for the rest of the season. Well, it's come out this year that most of them just didn't happen to make the team this year. They just didn't make the cut, and there's a lot of stuff that goes on like that around here. We're up against a lot in the South. A lot of Georgia is rural, and that story sounds like a day that ends in Y, unfortunately.
Very sad that that's the state of things, but that's why we're here, to change things, I suppose.
The South is getting organized, and there is at least the silver lining. There's a very exciting and energetic left wing energy emerging down here and all across the South.
Well, that's good. We did have some positive things come out, that a federal judge in D.C. ruled against some executive orders Trump made. Basically, Trump issued some executive orders limiting the rights of employees on what they could bargain under their union contract with the government. He limited the rights of union representatives to talk to employees, and he did a couple other miscellaneous things that were stripping the unions of their rights. The judge has struck down these orders, saying that he does not have the authority to do this. The Congress has set up legislation specifying how the unions interact with the government, and so he has no authority to be issuing proclamations on these issues, which is a good victory for unions in a time that they've been really getting hit with things like the Janus decision.
Yeah, the attack on labor is in full swing as it's ever been, for certain.
Last rapid file story is Verizon. They're in some hot water, metaphorically and literally speaking, I suppose, that they began throttling data in California. So one of the fire departments in California that is currently fighting the blazes going on there, it seems like half the state must be on fire at this point. The firefighters had an unlimited data plan, but because we exist in corporate America, unlimited actually means some data, and then we get to decide what happens to the rest of the data after you go past your arbitrary limit. They went past like 25 gigabytes worth of data and then began getting throttled down to dial-up speeds. Of course, they were using this data for their mobile command centers that was coordinating firefighting efforts, telling local communities what the status was, and handling things like evacuation orders and such. So getting throttled back to the 1990s probably wasn't the best for those efforts. They are now in legal trouble with the state and probably are going to get a pretty nasty judicial hammer swung on them given the climate in California.
Well, we'll see. You know, the telecoms do have a lot of power and a lot of sway, and they're some of the most hated companies in all of America. This was a really just unbelievable thing to read in the news, actually.
Well, they definitely aren't improving their reputation doing things like this. And I don't know, it seems like a goodwill gesture to give firefighters truly unlimited data, but it's one of those problems when people talk about benevolent capitalism. If capitalism can't even do something as simple as give firefighters, people literally going out and saving lives and keeping people's whole towns from burning down, can't do them any good, then what chance do the rest of us have, I suppose?
Sure.
Now we are going to move on to our final story of the night, and this is something that kind of brought you on the show to talk about because you have a lot more experience in this than I definitely do, that the prison strike 2018 is going on. prisoners across the United States have begun striking their prison labor jobs in demand for greater rights and better working conditions and fair wages, and basically what you see when any workers strike. That's pretty similar demands to any other union strike or worker strike. Of course, prisoners at this time do not have unions. I'm pretty sure they're banned from having unions in some places. But as some background on this, from what I've been reading and researching, that the jailhouse warriors wrote up some demands after various incidents happened. I know there was an uprising in South Carolina about a year ago, I believe. The jailhouse warriors were organizing this. I know the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee has been involved with this, as well as many other activist groups. For those who are unaware, and I've met people who are unaware of this, prison labor is a huge segment in the economy. Prison labor produces all kinds of things. I know people kind of have the stereotypical image of prisoners stamping out license plates for cars. In actuality, it extends far past just some state-run or businesses, as it were. That
huge, huge corporations benefit off of what is essentially slave labor, I'm sure you're about to get to.
Indeed. It's corporations. There is huge amounts of skilled and unskilled labor. It really is exploited out of. Off the top of my head, the agriculture, there's a lot of big agricultural businesses that use prison labor to work on their farms, which is, of course, perhaps the most direct parallel we can get to the 1800s when we had slave labor out on the plantations. But it even includes things like an article I'll have linked in the show notes. The Federal Department of Justice advertises customer support agents, that there are actually prisoners who run call centers and are call agents. And call agents aren't the most professional of jobs, but it is a good job that usually comes with good benefits and good pay. And these guys are, in some states, they don't get paid for it at all. And in most instances are being paid well below the minimum wage, 50 cents an hour or something ridiculous like that. And it is directly profiting these huge corporations that, instead of paying a worker a fair wage and fair benefits, they're getting to pay a prisoner what amounts to dollars a day for what is, yes, essentially slave labor.
I believe that in Florida, they can even be forced to work for nothing.
Yes, I know that there are some states that, yes, have that provision in there where you are working for nothing. I guess some people might say, well, they're working for their living conditions, but that's not really how that works. At the most generous, you can say you could compare it to indentured servitude, but in a lot of cases, it is just straight up prison slavery. And one of the demands that I've heard from these individuals is, and these activists that are working on their behalf, is a thing that we often gloss over, is in the 13th Amendment, which removed slavery from the United States. It has a specific exemption in there that unpaid servitude is banned except in the case of incarceration, essentially. But I've talked long enough on this. This is more your area of expertise at this time, so I'll hand the mic over to you and let you talk some about your experiences with this.
Sure. I'm not sure that it's my area of expertise, but I do have some background on it recently, and was at Lee Correctional yesterday protesting in solidarity with the prison strike. Everything you said, it was accurate. Prisoners are not treated with any humanity. They're it's essentially a continuation of the slaveholder sort of plantation system. And we know that the origins of the United States policing and prison system goes back to the days of slave catchers. And it's we know, I'm sure most of our listeners know, the huge amount of incarcerated people the United States has, just an absurd incarcerated population. And it's a very white supremacist system. So the current prison strike going on, and anyone who has not seen the prisoners' demands should definitely go online and check this out. It is an immensely exciting news. And this is the things like this, in addition to many other things I'm sure are going to be going on, this is how revolutions start. And it's an important thing to do, to fight for the rights of prisoners. And the prison strike is going on nationally in many different states. Many groups have signed on in solidarity, including Socialist Rifle Association. If you go to our website, socialistra.org, you can read a brief statement we wrote about it. And so yesterday, myself and some other comrades from the Atlanta branch of Party of Socialism and Liberation went up to Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina. It's a pretty good drive for me. It was over 4 hours both ways from my home in North Georgia, but I would have driven farther to go out to this action to support it. And this is the second time PSL Atlanta has been there at the prison protesting. The first time was after the deaths that you mentioned earlier, which I might get to here in a minute. We were joined by a bunch of other groups from all around. PSL alone had comrades from three different states come out. I know that Atlanta, Asheville, and local South Carolina PSL comrades were there. There were people from Workers' World Party. There was people from Socialist Party USA. There were local South Carolina abolition groups. There was actually big presence of Food Not Bombs, in addition to many other people. The turnout I thought was very good. My comrade Adam counted 72 people there when he did a head count. It lasted for almost 2 hours, and we just wanted the prisoners inside to know that they're not alone, that people on the outside, which are supporting them and standing for them and fighting for them. We had some speakers speak at the protest, including some folks who lost loved ones at Lee Correctional. A very moving speech by a mother who lost her son. And to be clear, the blood is absolutely on the hands of the guards at Lee Correctional for these deaths. At a minimum, that they let the deaths happen. And it's I felt like a pretty solid action. It's just good to show solidarity with the prisoners and let them just remind them that there are people on the outside that are fighting along with them. And so the strike is ongoing through September. Is it 8th or 9th? Do you know, Alex?
I believe it's September 8th. I believe it's the 9th.
The 9th. Okay, sorry about that. And so it was a good protest yesterday. We didn't have as many cops visible are giving us too much problems as we thought, but they were there. Of course, we got some support from passing by cars, and it's good to spread awareness and to be militant about these things. There's other actions going on all across the country right now, working along with the prison strike that they can get involved with. Atlanta, PSL Atlanta is actually next Sunday as well, having an author, Eugene Puryear, come to speak about his book about mass incarceration as another sort of prison strike related activity. There's been marches in Atlanta, and I just highly encourage people to check out anything that might be going on around them that they could do to get involved. If there are any local organizations or local activist groups in your area, and even if there's not, they always need people making phone calls. Making phone calls to prisons and correctional systems is hugely helpful as the strike's ongoing. There are scripts you can read and different numbers that you can be suggested to call. Maybe you can link to some resources for people who want to do calls, if you're able, Alex, in the show description. And just try to get involved as much as you can, because these prisoners are up against enormous odds. They're definitely being punished for trying to strike. When we were there at Lee Correctional yesterday, we were told that they're only being allowed to shower once a week. Can you imagine that? Only being allowed to shower once a week. They had cut visitation off entirely during our protest. Just as, again, vindictiveness, there's nobody allowed to visit in the prison. They're being kept down on lockdown most of the time. But we've been assured that the prisoners are, you know, in it to fight the good fight, that the incarcerated people are not going to be bullied. They're not going to be intimidated like this. But I mean, it's definitely helpful if socialists and communists and everyone else across the country could do whatever it is in their power to help them fight and show solidarity with them.
And, you know, I'll make sure I have plenty of resources available in the show notes for people who are interested in that. This is something that's interesting to me, and I don't know how much we want to get into it, because it, in some ways, just having the conversation distracts from what is going on right now and what needs to be done right now as far as this truly horrific system that we have set up across the United States. That I know when talking about this to people in my area. And because, of course, when you talk about this online, you're just inviting a lot of online discourse is disingenuous to begin with.
Sure.
Just because of the nature of how things work online. But oftentimes you can have better conversations in person. And what I found when talking to people on campus about this, that of course you expect something of, from the liberal mindset at least, that, okay, this is obviously very poor, very terrible treatment that these prisoners are experiencing. So what do you think? What do you think about this? And asking a liberal student in a progressive setting about that, you'd expect a better response. But I continually find people have this mindset, and I think this is kind of something that's been pushed on us as a society, that, and I find this interesting, that this is something I think is a more modern invention that we see. Of course, prisons have existed as long as civilization has existed, but the prison system as we know it has truly developed in the last few centuries.
Absolutely,
that,
yes.
That prisons of this nature were non-existent in olden times. It was, one, impractical to want, run these things, and two, law and order used to work a lot differently. But I think as part of, as we have built the modern prison system, as a society, we have incorporated this idea of, you have committed a crime, and therefore, why do you deserve any sympathy? Why do you deserve any respect and dignity when you have possibly taken that away from another individual? And particularly, I find people have this mindset that when they think of criminals, people don't think of the guy who got caught with an ounce of weed. They don't think about the individual who stole food for their family and has now ended up in a bad situation. And I don't know perhaps the best way to go countering this perception in society, because it seems like so often the debate comes back to, well, why should I support these people when there's murderers and arsonists and rapists in there? Why do they deserve my respect? And it's very concerning to me that we can so quickly dehumanize what is a huge chunk of the American population. America has the largest prison population in the world, despite by far not having the largest actual population in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing the degree to which the narrative that has been pushed by the capitalist ruling class in the United States is deeply entrenched into a lot of people's thinking. But nonetheless, I think it's extremely important that we're vigilant in fighting back to counter this narrative and to get the facts out there and to preach liberation to the rest of the working class. And looking at what the prisoners are wanting, one of the things that they're demanding is recognize our humanity. I mean, these are human beings that are being kept in cages, essentially just brutal conditions, essentially being used as slaves with the prison labor issue. We've got transgender people in prison that face an enormous problem of sexual assault, and it's just ways you wouldn't even think of animal living, that these are real people, human beings. And like you said, a lot of the people in there, Jack the Ripper is rare. a lot of the people are in there for drug offenses, and just even those who did perhaps commit horrible crimes, they don't lose their humanity when they go into prison. And the American prison system is so brutal. It's so oppressive. Like I said, it has its roots in the days of the slave catchers. It's a white supremacist institution, both the policings and the prison. And no matter how deeply ingrained the sort of thinking is into the American public, it just that should just double or triple our resolve to counter the narrative and to fight back for what's right. Because if we want to preach liberation for all people, that includes the huge amount of people in this country that are incarcerated.
Definitely. I think there is definitely a social activation energy, if you will, that we have to kind of overcome when discussing this topic, because, as you said, it should just make us want to push this even harder, because at the end of the day, these are workers, these are members of the working class, these are people that have as much of a right to basic dignity as anyone else. And I think it's kind of rooted in that societal notion that an eye for an eye.
Yeah. I mean, does it make society safer, this kind of mass incarceration? The answer is an unequivocal no. It does not make us safer as a society.
Certainly. And I think people have this notion that, well, these conditions have to be brutal because that's disincentive from committing crime. And, I mean, it's the double standards and the hypocrisies you find discussing this, because in the same breath that somebody can say, well, what about all these vicious murderers? Well, did the vicious murderer be deterred by the fact that prison's going to suck? It's probably not. And the decisions that people make are not rational a lot of the time. And so somebody probably isn't thinking, oh man, prison is going to be really bad. I probably shouldn't smoke this weed today. That's probably not the thought process that is going through people's mind. And no matter how vicious of a system you make, that's not going to achieve that supposed goal. And instead, it's just, unfortunately, a lot of it serves as a vent for societal rage that should honestly be directed in upwards rather than downwards. I think everyone can agree that the system needs a lot of change, and again, I will include resources for people who want to be able to go help in any way they can, be it phone calls, be it monetary support for institutions that are helping, organizations that are helping to change these things. I know some people have even done some simple things as sending encouraging letters to strikers. Anything helps, anything counts.
Absolutely. Pen pal programs with people on the inside is a great way that has been suggested to really, you know, connect to an incarcerated person yourself. Getting involved with local orgs if there's not any, you know, writing or calling in solidarity with the prison strike. There's a broad front of prison abolition and prisoner right work that people can get involved in, and is an important goal.
Indeed. So I think we'll close out the episode on that positive note to go out into the world and be the change you want to see.
Agree. That's a good way to end the episode. I really appreciate you having me on, Alex.
I thank you for having your time, and I know it's not always the easiest sitting down in front of a computer and talking for hours on end, but
well, it's not as bad as work.
Yeah. Yeah. So I appreciate you coming on and having this time with me and the listeners.
I enjoyed it, and I enjoy the podcast, and I enjoy being involved with Socialist Rifle Association. I've been amazed by the growth of the organization since I've been involved. It's been a little while, perhaps not as long as yourself, but a while, and the energy inside, and I feel like we're feeling a real need on the left as far as, you know, working class gun rights and advocacy and organization and training organization. We're not quite in the same niche as some of the other groups, like, Redneck Revolt or John Brown Gun Club, perhaps, that we're not militia-minded, but I think part of the response to SRA has been that something like this has been needed for a while, and I'm really proud of a lot of the work we do, and I can't wait to see what we've got in store in the future.
Yep, that's definitely exciting, the way the organization is going, and I know in our member chats that we have so many active people and so many people out on the ground.
Locals are springing up across the country and starting to have activities. And, you know, if you're listening and you're not a member yet, but you support what we do, you should definitely check it out and join us, socialistra.org.
Definitely. So we'll go ahead and I'll bid you a good night. And to the listeners, seize the means of production.
Have a good one.